Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Faith Church Podcast, Thanksgiving edition. I'm your host, Jay, and with me is Robbie.
Is it the Thanksgiving edition if it's at the week after Thanksgiving? That should have been last week.
Hey, everybody.
Should have said that last week.
Welcome to the Faith Church Podcast, Advent edition. Well, I was just, Thanksgiving's been on my mind because I think the last bit of leftovers, but pretty close.
Oh, nice.
Because we're on to turkey gravy, biscuits and turkey gravy.
Mm. Mm,
yep. That's what I have for lunch today, which is not what you would call a power lunch.
No? Wait. Did you just say turkey gravy or
turkey
is
gravy.
It on something?
And biscuits.
And biscuits. Okay, I was going to say.
Feel like we're having a thing. If people aren't aware, so far today, Robbie, we're deciding that my voice is maybe at a frequency that Robbie struggles to hear, like a dog whistle.
No, it's that Robbie's brain is addled.
No, you.
So
yeah.
I heard that, and only half of what you said registered, and I was like, wait a minute, you're having gravy for lunch? That seems like a cry for help.
I feel like
I should intervene.
Turkey gravy is healthier than other forms of gravy, from what I understand, because turkey is leaner.
Oh.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Is it?
But, and then on biscuits. So this this is not boding well for my...
Sounds delicious.
It is delicious, but it's sleepy. So question, Robbie. So since we're post-Thanksgiving, and I realize we talked about pumpkins over the fall, we've done that twice in a row, but I don't think I've ever asked you, what's your favorite leftover from Thanksgiving? Like, is there anything that you... The next day, you're like, that's what I...
That is a good question. I like all of the leftovers. Although,
okay,
I like the sides more. Like, the one thing that I could do without is the actual turkey.
Okay.
Like, we had an incident where we almost had no turkey at Thanksgiving, and I was going to be totally fine with that. So, it turned out that
we did. Me too, actually.
But I'm all about the side dishes on Thanksgiving. So all of the side dishes, I think in particular, green bean casserole.
I was going to say that at the same time. I'm going to say green bean casserole. In my mind, I thought it's going to be funny because I'll be like, same thing at the same time, but joking because I didn't think anybody else would say that.
No. Oh,
but you were saying it.
With the crispy
Robbie,
onion strings
yes.
on top, I love
okay,
green bean
but
casserole.
Question.
Also sweet potato casserole. So if I get two things.
Then you're good.
I'm stoked.
Okay, so, but real green beans or canned green beans? In the green bean casserole.
Come on, three.
What are you, 1, 2, 3.
Real
canned.
Green greens.
Oh, come on, man.
Real green beans.
No, not in the green bean casserole, man. The green bean casserole has to be canned green beans and canned cream of mushroom soup and canned crispy onion straws.
I don't mind the Campbell's cream of mushroom soup. There are certain things that require... Canned cream. Now, I don't ever want to eat a bowl of Campbell's cream of mushroom soup, but put that in some stuff. Yeah, buddy.
Okay, but yeah, I have to say, I mean, I'm a fan of real green beans for everything else.
Yeah.
But canned green beans and the green bean casserole. One time Lauren made it with real green beans, and I was like, what is this? this is like green beans just drowning in cream of mushroom soup, and that real green beans don't need that.
Just don't work with that.
And so, yeah.
Now I even doubt myself. Now I'm trying to think back if I've ever had fresh green beans. Do we keep saying real green beans?
Fresh
they're
green beans.
They're not artificial
Sorry,
green
that's
beans.
True.
I'm pretty sure they're
that's
not.
True. Well, maybe they are, Robbie. You don't know what the government
created the green beans.
Yeah, you don't know what the government does to the green beans.
I don't.
Listen, wait a second. So you're saying you don't know? I'm so confused.
Now I'm trying to realize if I assume. Now I'm doubting myself.
You don't know that you've actually had them with real green, with fresh green beans.
Across the board, I prefer fresh green beans, but now you're making me doubt myself.
Most people prefer fresh
green
beans. Okay. Well, you go figure that out because I think most people's experience of green bean casserole is with canned green beans.
I'm going to go home and make a fresh green bean casserole and see if
it's just not the same. It's not because it's the texture too. Like you need the mushiness. There's just something about the crispiness of the onion straw, but when you get the crispiness of the green, like a properly cooked fresh green bean, which should be
a little
crunchy, and there's just something about it. It's just not it doesn't mesh together as well. I'm just saying.
You may have persuaded me.
It's all right. Well, we'll find that out. So okay. this isn't that important. So, but we did figure out that you are a leftover guy, that you like to kind of recreate the Thanksgiving, because that's one of the ways to enjoy Thanksgiving leftovers. Is some people, I'm the recreate the meal I had for Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. and then there are the people who say I'm going to turn it into a sandwich, like the whole Thanksgiving sandwich.
I want a plate. Similar to the plate that I had that day.
Yeah, I'm that way too. I tried the sandwich thing this year, and I was like, it was underwhelming.
Yeah,
just give me all the things the way I had them.
Just give me
before.
A pile of the good stuff.
Yep. Okay. Good. Well, moving on. I think that's it. Is that pretty much all you had about the sermon this week?
I think that's good. I think that covers.
So one of the
God's extravagance.
One of the reasons why we're saying that Robbie, that I'm speaking on a frequency, is one of the things that Robbie suggested, like, hey, would you want to say this? Because I was thinking this during your sermon, and then proceeded to say basically verbatim something I said in the sermon. So much so that I thought it was a joke. You said, you know, I think maybe you'd want to say this because I think this would be a really good point. And I'm like, wait, are you saying it was a good point in the sermon? Or are you being funny? And it turns out that Robbie, we just realized that Robbie wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, but my takeaway is we were in agreement.
That's your takeaway.
Had the same.
Okay, so why don't you say what the point was? Because let's talk about that. And
so what you evidently said with clarity and convincing persuasion, so much so that it burrowed deep into my subconscious. Was this idea of when you're reading through the parable of the lost son, or we call the prodigal son, there is this stark reality that both sons reject the love of the father, right? They're just coming at it from completely different angles. We typically see that as the one son who has rejected the love of the father and he runs away, while the other one stays faithful. But the reality is, in the end, you know, you see the big reveal, the conclusion, the punchline, in a sense, is the older brother who has also rejected the love of the father, that it's not the love of the father that is motivating him. It's, you know, both of them want the stuff, but aren't really responding to the father's love. And evidently, you did a fantastic job of saying exactly that in the sermon. Well done.
Well, no, nobody's going to say, no one's ever going to describe anything I say in a sermon as with excellent clarity or whatever it was. So, but I did contrast that of saying they both reject intimacy with the father. The younger son does it by demanding his inheritance and saying and outrightly claiming, I want the stuff, not you. But the older brother does it in the sense that he's also wanting the stuff. He just is doing it. He thought that he'd earned his place with the father. So they're both rejecting the love and the grace of the father, one by running away, the other by believing that he has earned it or is entitled to it because of his works. And that is an interesting contrast. What's interesting, though, is at the end, it's the older brother who doesn't actually come in,
right?
And refuses. He rides that to the end, and refuses to accept the grace and the mercy of the father, and more, I think more accurately, refuses to accept that he's also in need of that.
Yes.
So he's going to double down on his works and his indignation at the father for allowing the younger brother in.
Right. Because both of them seem to be operating with that scarcity mentality that you mentioned in the sermon. That idea of, instead of an abundance mentality, they're operating with a scarcity mentality. And
right.
the younger brother, the idea is, well, I need to get while the getting's good. Right. Mm-hmm. I need to get my stuff and go while I can have it. And the older brother sees this celebration that he's invited to. And instead of interpreting that as, man, this is awesome, I get to be a part of enjoying this feast with the fatted calf, he somehow interprets this as, this is something being withheld from me. This is something I'm now not getting. And so they both misinterpret the father's love, the father's provision, and operate with this scarcity mentality. So you talked about that in the sermon. Where does that come from? Why is it that when we read scripture and we see, God owns the cattle on a thousand hills, and we see Jesus, we read Jesus teaching about how, you know, God provides all things, and we read that and we declare that, and then we tend to then operate though with the assumption that God's blessing is limited. If you get something that I don't, then that's, I'm missing out, and that's somehow now something I can't get because you got blessed with that, or I'm unwilling to share my gifts, my blessings, because I'm afraid I'm going to run out. Like we see this thing in Scripture about God's extravagance and His abundance, but then we operate with this assumption of scarcity. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a couple of thoughts that enter my mind. One is because that's the way we function in our world. I mean, everything we know is scarce. Every resource, our days are scarce. Our money is scarce. Like if you get passed over for a promotion, if somebody else gets a promotion that you were vying for, then you don't get that promotion. If somebody, if there is a bonus to be had and one person gets that bonus, you don't get that bonus. There's not unlimited resources of that. If you, and so I think what happens is because that's the way we function in the world, it's what we see all the time. And what that means then is all of our idols are limited. So anything I chase is, like, if what I'm chasing is power and influence, well, if you get it, I don't get it. Or an inheritance from, like, limited earthly inheritance from parents. Like, if you're my brother and you get X number of dollars from mom and dad, then I don't get those dollars. Like, everything in our world is limited. It's finite. It's fragile. And so that's the great contrast with God. And I think, so it's such a great picture of how, even when we think we don't do it, we insist on basically reducing God to something we can fully understand. We want to compare it. And there are ways that that is good in Scripture. Like, we would not understand anything about God if it wasn't for metaphor and, you know, God reducing Himself in some way. The incarnation is that. Like, we just, we can't possibly understand the things of God. But the danger becomes when we assume that that metaphor is the whole of who God is.
That's good.
And so if we don't believe that God actually, we don't have any way to understand God's infinite wealth and riches. We don't have any way to understand a being that is the source of all things. Yeah. It shows up a lot, like with kids. One of the hardest things for kids to grasp is, like, well, what was it like before God existed? You know, or like that God wasn't created. Like, you just, because you don't have any frame of reference. We don't know anything that is eternal. We don't understand eternal because there's nothing in our experience that is eternal, like our tangible experience. So we try to imagine what that could look like, but that's the best we can do. And so when it comes to God's endless riches and how He has everything at His command, because He's the source of all things, like He's this constant, endless source of all things, we just, it's so hard for us to grasp or understand. And so we then minimize it or reduce it to something we can't understand. And so I think that's a big part of it. Like, we just compare Him to the idols that we have created and we just don't understand it. And so then ultimately, then that comes to the bigger issue, which is we just don't believe Him then.
Yeah.
Because we don't understand it, we just flat out don't believe. Because, and we'll talk about this next week, but in the sermon, but if you believe, Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount of, like, do not worry, do not be anxious. And like I said, we'll preach on that this coming weekend. But the idea is God, like, look around you. God's endless wealth is, you're surrounded by it. And so if that's the case, well, obviously He's going to take care of you. And if you don't believe that, like, then the question is, like, well, do I, it's just a simple matter of fact question of, like, do you believe that that's who He is or do you not? And I wish I could make it more complicated than that. Like, that ultimately it comes down, I guess I did make it more complicated by going on for 10 minutes about whatever I just went on about. Yeah. Good job making it complicated. But I was trying to explain, like, why it's hard for us to grasp.
Right.
And why then it is just a matter of, do you believe it or not? Like, right. This is where faith comes in, is like, I just can't get to a place where it's going, where I'm going to get a something that's going to show me, like, okay, well, this is what it means. This is what it's like, because I don't have any frame of reference for it. So then the question is, do I believe it or do I not?
Right. When God says, I'm not constrained by those same limitations, do I believe him or do I think he's a liar?
Right. That seems awfully harsh.
If he's saying A and I say, I don't think A is true, then I'm assuming he's either ignorant or a liar, right? So right. I think that's simplification. It's not an oversimplification. It really is that simple. If God says, I am not confined by those limitations, then the choice simply is, do I believe him or do I disbelieve him? And if I believe him, then that results in me living with an abundance mentality, because I trust him that he truly is over everything and has everything and is providing everything. And if I don't believe him, then I don't operate that way at all.
So why do we complicate it?
Because that's safer. It's way more safe to complicate it, because then if I don't, if what you're saying is true and it literally just boils down to belief or unbelief, then that's entirely my fault. That's on me, right? My issue is, well, I don't believe and I'm not obeying. Where if I complicate it, then I can add nuance and excuses, right? Well, these are the reasons why, you know, I don't believe this, or why it's hard to believe this, or why this doesn't apply to me. And so we like to complicate things, because then that gives me more outs, where if it just boils down to Jesus said you should do this, therefore he expects me to do that. Or if I believe him, then I'll do that. And if I don't believe him, then I won't. That really does put all the responsibility on me. That's pretty binary, right?
It is. I think there is a difference between acknowledging it is hard to believe.
Yes.
Or acknowledging that, like, the fear that's there, or how scary it is to take those steps of faith. But I think what our complicating of issues like this, what it does is it gives us an out to where we don't even have to confront that issue.
Right.
I can already make it about this other thing. So for example, like, we'll talk about being generous in giving and generous in our time and that if we believe, but ultimately this idea of abundance mentality is that there's plenty. And you know, we've all been in situations like, there's a huge difference between, like, if you're at a Thanksgiving dinner and there is plenty to go around, like, we actually, you know, if there's lots of it, then everybody's super generous, like, eat all you want, right, or whatever. But if you don't have turkey there, or it's a really tiny turkey and you realize this isn't going to feed everybody, then there's a scarcity mentality, or a sense of, like, hey, just have a little bit, just have what you need, take a small reasonable portion. And I think if we have the conversation about, okay, well, what does it look like to be a good steward, or what does it look like to, what's wise, what's foolish when it comes to our resources and everything? Those are important conversations. But what happens is, if we can use all of those nuances to cover for this root thing of, like, well, wait, but where am I starting? What's my starting point?
That's right.
I believe that God is abundant, you know, there's an abundance, actually an abundance of time, an abundance of money, an abundance of resources, an abundance of all these things. Am I functioning from that place, or am I functioning from a place that says, no, I don't actually think he has all that. Like, I have to take control of something. I have to manage these resources because they're limited.
So maybe would you say we're complicating the wrong end of the issue? Right. We want to complicate the whether or not I have to obey that or believe that.
Yes.
And then simplify what it looks like, right? instead of simplifying, well, should I believe this? Well, did God say it? Then yes, I should believe that. Should I obey this? Well, did God declare it? Then yes, you should obey it. That's the easy part. That's very simple. If Jesus said I should do it, I should do it. Jesus says love your enemies. There's nothing complicated about that, whether or not I should seek to do that. Now, it can be complicated on what that looks like, because there's a lot of different, there's limitless circumstances of what you would consider an enemy, how you have been wronged, how you've been hurt. Like, so there's going to be, it's going to take some effort, some work, some counsel, some discipleship to work through sometimes what that looks like and how to do that in a given situation. But the whether or not I should love my enemies, whether or not I should, trust God as my provider, like those things are actually not complicated at all. And that's, so I can get derailed before I even get to the actual hard part by complicating the easy part.
The irony of us having a conversation right now about complicating and simplifying things. This feels very complicated. However, I think that's a really good point. And what you, as you're saying that, it makes me think, okay, so yeah, you're right. I think we overcomplicate what is supposed to be simple, and we oversimplify what is supposed to be more complex.
Which was actually kind of the basis of the basic series of saying, we've overcomplicated some things, we need to simplify.
Right. Yeah. And so, but what's interesting is we use the simplification of the wrong thing to not deal with the simple thing. So what will happen is, for example, when we look at, you could say right now in this conversation of like, well, abundance mentality. So then are you saying we should just give away everything, just be frivolous and with our money and, not be good stewards? Like the whole straw man argument. So you're saying, and then you just feel some extreme thing. You're actually oversimplifying the nuanced version of how this plays out.
That's right.
As a way of distracting from the what is supposed to be the simple issue at hand.
Yeah. Whether or not I believe and obey.
Right. And we see this in our culture. So for example, let's say if someone, we talked about this as a staff, and so you can edit this out later if you want to, but we talked about this as a staff. Like if I stood up there and said, I believe that everybody should have access to good medical care. Well, immediately people are going, oh, so you're saying, and then you're going to fill in the blanks of all kinds of arguments of talking about socialistic medicine, medical care and all that stuff. Like, no. I'm talking like you're oversimplifying solutions and saying like, oh, well, then you mean this or this. Like, no, there's lots of nuances about how that could take place. And it's a very complex issue of how to go about doing that. But if you use that simple thing to then keep yourself distract from the simple thing of, no, we're just saying, like, I just think everybody should have health care.
Should we be allowing people to die in our streets, or should we treat image bearers of God with dignity and respect and care?
Yeah. Like, which feels like, start there.
Start there. If we can. Right. We can.
And you see that all the time. So forgiveness is one of those things. Like if we say we're supposed to forgive as God has forgiven us, well, then a lot of times people will say like, well, what if, and then you talk about some horrifying situation that is probably very real for some people about like, well, then we're just supposed to, or turn the other cheek. Like, so I'm just supposed to let whatever. And like,
pretend like this never happened.
Right. Pretend like this never happened. Supposed
no,
to just
of course not.
Like, no. Yeah, right. No, you're oversimplifying into a straw man. What this looks like fleshing out. But you're doing it to distract from the real issue that,
you don't want to obey him.
Like you don't want to forgive. But we want to start there and say, well, obviously we are called to forgive. Now, what does that look like? I mean, you and I both counseled people in situations where forgiveness for one person might mean reconciliation, might mean like full reconciliation and full like restoration of the relationship. But there have been situations where both of us have been in your counseling in a situation where you would say forgiveness is not going to look like restoration or reconciliation on this side of eternity.
That's right.
Like forgiveness is going to be more of an act of faith that Jesus is going to make all this right, and he will reconcile all things and restore all things, but that's gonna have to wait for that.
That's right. Yeah.
Because it's complicated. Like, that part is complicated. What isn't complicated is the command to forgive, and your father will forgive you. If you do not forgive, your father will not forgive you. Like,
that's horrifyingly uncomplicated.
Right. Horrifyingly uncomplicated. So I do think it's important for us to realize, I think that's a really good distinction of saying, let's make sure that we aren't overcomplicating the simple things, and that we're not oversimplifying the more complex things.
I'm afraid to add anything to that, and therefore complicate it.
Oh my goodness. If this is somebody's first podcast that they've listened to from us,
I've never heard a more complicated discussion on simplicity in my whole life.
Okay, well, let's think about this a little more practically then. We just had that big theoretical discussion. Are there other things that you can think of where we tend to overcomplicate something that is very simple, or simplifying the more complex, nuanced way that something fleshes out as a way of kind of distracting, or as a way of trying to complicate the very simple thing?
I mean,
was there not to overplay this bit, but that was a very complicated way to ask that question. This is the irony of this podcast is just dripping all over the place. It's just
the title of this one is going to be the most complicated discussion ever on simplicity.
So we
talked about loving your enemies. Jesus also talks about loving your neighbor, right? And and someone else comes to him and is like, well, I mean, this is a pretty confusing teaching, Jesus. Like, I need you to clarify this for me. Like, he's in scripture, he's trying to complicate it. We've never actually evidently grown past that, because I find myself still doing what the guy who came to him and asked the question was doing. But so Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself. And his response is, yeah, but who is my neighbor really? And then Jesus gives this, you know, now famous parable, right? The Good Samaritan, which even that name is a little insulting,
right?
Like, this is an outlier. He's actually a good one.
The Good Samaritan.
The rest of the Samaritans. But I mean, that was the mentality of his audience at the time, is there was no such thing as a Good Samaritan. And so the example that Jesus uses is not even his audience doing something kind for the hated person. It's the hated person that's the hero of the story, who's doing the kind thing for a member of his audience. And so Jesus sets up the, you know, oh, you're trying to make this really complicated? How about this? Think of the worst person you could possibly think of. That qualifies as your neighbor. Therefore, everybody else is included in that as well. But then we can do exactly what that original guy in the gospel narrative does, and just say, well, but not this person, right? Does it have to be this person? We complicate that initial thing instead of starting from the point of, well, Jesus said, love my neighbor. So the question is not, do I love my neighbor? The question isn't even, who is my neighbor? Because his answer was, anyone who is around me. The question then becomes, so how do I do that well? That's where I need your help, right? I don't need you to help convince me, do I need to love my neighbor? Because that's, to your point, the issue of either belief or unbelief. Obedience or disobedience. That's the simple part. Where I need your help, where I need your discipleship, where I need my brothers and sisters to walk alongside me, is sometimes that's super easy and it's really well received by people, and sometimes it's super difficult and complicated and I don't really know the best way to help. And that's where there's nuance and I need help.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we see this all the time. Like, if starting, I find it really helpful in situations where things feel very complicated or feel very overwhelming. And then what I want to try to do is simplify it at its most foundational level. Yep. To get kind of my bearings of, like, okay, what's the starting point? Mm-hmm. You know, like, I've had those situations where, you know, especially in interpersonal relationships, where you feel like this person has wronged me in such a way, and I can get myself so psyched out about what does reconciliation look like, and how could I ever get to that? I'm getting lost on the complication rather than starting at like, well, obviously I'm starting at this point where forgiveness is what I want to pursue. Yeah. And I want to pursue reconciliation, whatever that looks like. And that can really change things. I think about the accusations of Jesus violating the Sabbath. And specifically, I was thinking about when you have the man with the withered hand and they're like, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Like that's them trying to make something that is very nuanced, very black and white. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And they're complicating the wrong issue. They're trying to complicate the very basic thing where Jesus says, like in Mark's account, says like, is it lawful to do good or to do evil on the Sabbath? Right. Like which one do you think God is gonna be honored by on the Sabbath, is good or evil? So that's actually the very simple thing. Whereas they're like trying to get into the weeds of like this, they're trying to argue about this thing they're trying to oversimplify what is actually complex playing out of it, and doing that in order to distract from the root thing, which Jesus is saying, you're going to do good or you're going to do evil. And same way with the Good Samaritan, like, well, who's the neighbor? Like you want to start at this basic level, this foundational level. And I think we're just so wired to want to make things complex and to want, like, but it's not really that we want to make things complex. I think the bigger thing is we just want to protect ourselves from having to believe things that are scary to believe.
Yeah. I want to keep it at arm's length.
Yeah.
And so for the Pharisees, it is costly for them to know the answer to that question, right? Mm-hmm. Because then they have to address, especially once he says, well, is it lawful to do good or to do evil? Like if it's really that simple, then they have to address the fact that this dude is likely in the synagogue week in and week out, and they have done nothing to ease the suffering of somebody that's under their care. So much better to keep it theoretical,
right,
and talk about concepts of Sabbath and not deal with the reality of we did nothing to care for one of our own suffering congregants for who knows how long. That is a heart issue that I have to deal with. And because I'd prefer comfort, I want to keep that at arm's length, but we can't do that. We need to, our sanctification process ends up getting stalled because of our unwillingness to keep simple what is simple and say, like, literally, well, if Jesus commanded it, I should do that. It should be that simple. And then I actually spend my time trying to work out the difficult things that matter of how do I do this best? How do I do this most faithfully? How do I do this in a way that yields, you know, 100-fold instead of just 10-fold, you know, based on the gifts that he's given me? Like, those are much better questions than should I or should I not believe or obey Jesus? I mean, those are also very important questions, but that's not where we should get hung up.
Especially
within the church, our answer should be, yes, we should believe him. Yes, we should obey him. Now, together, let's figure out how to do that well.
Yeah, so another one popped in my head. Do we have time for one more?
Yeah.
I keep trying. So here's my personality. When I realize I've made things overcomplicated, I try then to talk more about it, hoping that at some point it'll feel simpler.
More words.
It's a character flaw.
Make things more simple.
Yeah, it's a character flaw.
That was ironic.
So yeah, more. That was. So, but I'm thinking about caring for orphans. So that's one that, you know, obviously we talk about that as a church a lot. And often, even in my own heart and in conversations, when we start talking about that, people will go to, again, an extreme or start talking about how that plays out and saying like, well, we can't all adopt. Are you saying that everyone is called to adopt? But what happens is we end up having that kind of extreme conversation in our own heads and our own minds, and that ends up we're oversimplifying
Right.
The playing out of that by saying that caring for orphans means either I'm supposed to adopt a child or I'm not.
Right.
And that's oversimplifying what caring for orphans means. So that's an example of like, okay, I've oversimplified what caring for orphans means. And in doing that, I've distracted myself from the core issue, which is actually very simple, which is, yes, you are to care for orphans. So by oversimplifying what caring for orphans means, I've overcomplicated the issue of Right. Do I care for orphans? And where I need to start with is, okay, obviously, yes.
Obviously, yes.
Obviously, we need to care for orphans. Okay, what does that look like?
How
am I supposed to do that? What are all the different ways? How do we do that as a church? What does it look like as a church to do that? What does it look like as a family? What does it look like for my family to do that? And to start there. But what happens often is we use this oversimplification, this reductionist view of how to apply it to then just not have to deal with whether I'm actually doing the thing Jesus calls me to do and what scripture commands me to do. And so that's why, like, then, okay, there's a million different ways to care for orphans. Like, we have the welcomed ministry. You can mow a lawn for a family that has a foster child. You can take a foster child out for breakfast. You can support a family that is in the process of adopting. You can financially help to facilitate that. You can participate in that even in the church family by being extended family and all those different things. There's just so many different ways, but our heart posture should be to care for orphans. Like, that should be that's the simple, clear cut, obvious, like, if I believe that my Father has adopted me into the family of God, then therefore I want to be an instrument of that and help facilitate all children finding families and being adopted into homes. Okay. That's very simple. That's very direct. That's very clear cut. And then we figure out together, what does that look like? That's a pretty good example.
I love that example.
Well, of course you love that example, but I think it's important that we like understand, like, hey, that's an important thing. Like, you're not the only one that gets to claim that, like, just because you guys have, you know, you've adopted two children. And so it's easy to be like, oh, well, that's the Helene's thing. Like, no, it's not. Right. It's the church's thing.
Also, not okay for me to say, check that box.
Right. Also,
good
right,
to go.
Right. Yeah. Like,
no, that is a continuous rhythm of life.
I love the idea of you being like, I already did my part. Like, don't ask. Right. You know, like, obviously, that's horrible.
Right. Now I just got to go find a widow.
Right.
Check.
Now you can check. I got to. Oh, my goodness.
Do a nice thing for a widow. Check. Like, no.
It's like merit badges.
A rhythm. Right. Exactly. Like, we're not earning a merit badge of I have qualified for this thing. It is a rhythm of caring for those who are unable to care for themselves, for the marginalized, for those on the fringes of our churches and our neighborhoods. Like, those are the things, like, the whole New Testament is saturated. Like, the when Paul comes to the Jerusalem Council and they're like trying to figure out, like, is this dude here to kill us all or is he actually on our team? And they establish he's on our team. They're like, okay, awesome. Well, okay, so preach the gospel. Also, don't neglect the poor. Like, that's the right out of the gate is, hey, yeah, don't forget those who can't care for themselves. And Paul's response is, obviously, like, that's a given. Like, surely, right, like, that's the first thing out of the gate. So there, understanding that the first step is to believe and to obey. And then the real question is, so how do we do that? How do we do that together? What is a lifestyle or rhythm of that look like? And we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks of setting up the rhythms of your life in such a way that you live extravagantly to reflect and demonstrate the extravagant God. That's a way more fun, complicated.
Yes.
Right? The fun of how can we meet these needs? How can we get even better at serving and loving people? Like, that's a way more fun and worthwhile complicated than the discussions we typically find ourselves trapped in.
And that's that right there, that was worth the price of admission right there, because that's the abundance mentality. The abundance mentality is that well, obviously if this is what God is calling us to do, he is providing us with all the resources, all the time, yeah. all the money, yeah. all the giftings to be able to do this. And so an abundance mentality thinks, how do I give more? How do we care for people more? How do we do more because we have all this abundance? Whereas a scarcity mentality is more of the checkbox, you know, checking the box mentality of
That's right.
like, if I do this over here, then I've checked that box, and it's trying to reduce it. But an abundance mentality is just way more fun. And when you realize that that is the reality, then it's actually really exciting and just fun to go down that road.
Love that.
So
that's the kind of fun we want to have with you, church. So if we can help you in that, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. We want to have those kind of discussions with you most of all. How can we obey? How can we be a blessing in the ways that we have been blessed? How can we have an extraordinary impact on the other members of this church, the community that God has placed us in, and the relationships that the Holy Spirit has placed you in? So please don't hesitate to grab us on a Sunday morning. You can email us at connect@faithpeshtigo.com. And in the meantime, grace and peace to you.